Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for June 15th, 2014. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and joining me, as she does each and every week, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
Yes, and welcome from Mississippi for about the umpteenth time, one of our favorite guest hosts, Mr. Robert Hooks.
And for the umpteenth time, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you've been on enough that we've lost track. Yeah, but yeah, Thanksgiving coming on in. We're going to talk about some Magnolia State politics here in a minute. But I tell you what, about this time last year, I was coming through Mississippi. I went to Texas vacation, and it made me remember traveling up the southeastern part of the state where Southern Miss is. We got off for lunch and found an IHOP that must be the most popular IHOP in America, Robert. There were people waiting in the line. I think that the wait was going to be over an hour. You know, it's the one across from the campus of Southern Mississippi, beautiful college, by the way, but in Hattiesburg. But this IHOP, you know, they used to be called International House of Pancakes. Nobody calls it anymore. I began to think if I had the crepes, I would have been, like, transformed to the French Riviera or to the foot of the Eiffel Tower or something, the way the people are waiting. Robert, what's going on with that IHOP in Mississippi?
Well, let me tell you something. I have stood in that line and eaten at that IHOP on many, many a time over many, many a year. I remember when I was a student at Southern Miss, that IHOP was open 24 hours a day. And I realized that they must have been doing just almost too much business when they started closing it at midnight, which broke my heart because some of my best memories were in that IHOP at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. But it is, you know, it's in just an incredible location. I mean, you've got two of the busiest roads in Mississippi right across the street from the university and very inexpensive, highly starchy food. So...
Yeah, it sounds like the Waffle House and Crystal of my college. Those are the two places. We didn't have an IHOP in Rome at that point. I think that was kind of when IHOP was in a lull. And then, of course, they heard about what was going on in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and it went nuts. But speaking of open and, you know, new exciting things, apparently, you know, this is the time of year where people go to amusement parks and new roller coasters open up, and the new exciting roller coaster ride in Mississippi would be the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate. Since you were on the show last, this thing went into overtime. You, I believe, called it back in, like, February that there was a chance that it would be one of those 48-48-4 deals where somebody that nobody had hardly ever heard of could push this thing into a runoff, and sure enough, it happened. What exactly caused that, Robert?
You know, I published an article in October of last year in which I laid out a case for why I thought Senator Cochran was vulnerable in the Republican primary. I didn't say he was going to be beaten. I merely stated that there was a path to victory for someone coming from his right. I laid out the number of people who I thought would likely vote in that kind of scenario, what the issues would have to be, what the candidate would have to do. And it's still published on the Mississippi Machiavelli Facebook page. And I said that it would take about 300,000 votes, what I thought would happen to have the kind of energy necessary to take out an incumbent senator. And I will tell you, I was called every sort of insult, and I understood it. But people, Democrat and Republican alike, simply thought it was impossible, that Thad Cochran could not be beaten. And not only did he come in second, but there were about 300, in fact, turned out being about 310,000 people that showed up and voted. You had both a long-term senator who had not been seriously challenged since the 80s. You had a new generation of people that had that knew the name but had never talked to him, had never seen him, only sort of recognized his face, did not recognize his voice, and a Republican primary electorate that bore no resemblance to the man himself. The Republican primary all over the country, but particularly here in the Deep South, is just a different ball of wax. So for a person whose credits include a lot of skill at governing, running inside a Republican primary that puts no emphasis on your skill at governing, in fact, seems to despise government itself, it just there just was no there for him to ever get his to ever really convince GOP voters he was still their guy. And if you look, the very rural parts of the state supported him. Republican voters in the Delta, perhaps the most racially polarized part of the country, they actually supported him because his opponent has been so opposed to the farm bill and agriculture subsidies. The hills, the Northeast hills, supported him. They're fairly conservative in the classical sense of the word. They're not. They weren't as convinced about an upstart they'd never heard of from the southern part of the state voting for him. But where he really had trouble were in high population counties that are traditional Republican strongholds like suburban Memphis and suburban Jackson, the counties that Republicans rely upon for their general election victories. They just split down the middle and allowed South Mississippi, where his opponent Chris McDaniels was from, to vote overwhelmingly for Chris. So you wound up having these counties that Thad Cochran would win, but he would win just barely. And then these counties that Chris McDaniels would win, he would win overwhelmingly. Thad Cochran is not going back to the Senate. He will not win the runoff. His campaign has been waged with absolute incompetence. The people who are running his campaign are not worthy of the man from whom they are working. And I say that as someone who would never vote for Senator Cochran. But his campaign has been a joke. He is not, but his campaign has been. And that, as much as anything else, is why he lost. They never took their opponent seriously until it was too late.
Yes, David Neer was on the show last week, and he pointed out something we discussed this race, that Senator Cochran tried to get a lot of crossover Democrats to support him, including African-American voters. And then, of course, if those voters voted in the Democratic primary for other races, then there's no way they can now vote, support him in the runoff. Was that effort really very successful? Because it sounds like it wouldn't have been a good tactic anyway.
It was a very bad idea. It was a social media-created energy. And I honestly am unable to tell you at this point how successful it was. The voter file will be updated next week, and it would not take but a few seconds to look and see how successful it was. I would be very surprised if you had a lot of African-American voters showing up to the Republican primary. There may have been a lot of energy among Democrats, very liberal Democrats, white and black, in the Jackson metro area. But there was a very interesting congressional race in South Mississippi where a former Democratic, long-serving, well-respected Democratic congressman who had been defeated in the Tea Party wave of 2010 switched parties to run in the Republican primary against the man who defeated him. While everyone rolled their eyes at Gene Taylor running as a Republican, truth was Congressman Taylor had a lot of support, Democrat, Republican, and independent. And it's not inconceivable that in those South Mississippi counties where he was popular, that you did have a lot of people who came to vote for him that then voted for Thad Cochran in the primary. They didn't do it to vote for Thad. They did it to vote for Gene Taylor. But that's possible. In right there on the beach, Harrison County, Biloxi, Gulfport, that area, Jackson County, Pascagoula, Moss Point, those, and of course Hancock County, Bay St. Louis, where Congressman Taylor is from. It's possible you saw some of that. But ultimately, it was a bad idea. Every Democratic leader in the state begged Democrats not to do that, to let the Republicans create their own follies and for us not to be a part of it. And ultimately, it failed. Gene Taylor lost, and Thad Cochran came in second.
Yes. Catherine, any questions on the U.S. Senate race, including moving this thing to the general?
Well, when's the runoff?
The 24th.
So what do you think they'll be up to between now and then? Are they frantically campaigning, or is it pretty quiet?
Chris McDaniels is frantically campaigning. Ron Paul came for a huge event that he had, just as Sarah Palin had come just a couple of days before the primary. Chris McDaniels is everywhere at once. I have to give his campaign respect. His campaign touring schedule is as intense as any I have ever seen in the state. He's everywhere. And Thad Cochran is virtually non-existent. I don't know if Senator Cochran can't do it anymore. I don't know if that's true. I can tell you he is not doing it. He will not speak to the press. He will not grant interviews, no press conferences, no town hall meetings, nothing. And the few times that he speaks to a civic group that the press is there, it's a befuddlement. He made a joke that was absolutely harmless, but it was just a joke that old men in the South sometimes tell that just shows how absolutely out of touch with the modern world that he is. He told a joke about he was in Forest County, right where that IHOP is, as a matter of fact, right across the street from that IHOP you were talking about earlier. And he was talking about how he used to spend his summers there in the Pine Belt, and he made this little quip about growing up having done innumerable indecent things with farm animals. And it was just a joke that around 25, 60 and 70-year-old men, everyone would have laughed and not thought anything about. Well, you can imagine that was the quote that went all over the press, all over social media. Not that anyone thought he was really saying he had done those things, but it was just to say, is there anything that this campaign can get right? Can you not make one single stop and get it right? And they clearly can't. And it's amazing because Governor Barber's, former Governor Haley Barber's team is running the third-party expenditure. His nephew, Austin Barber, is running the third-party expenditure called Mississippi Conservatives. And his other nephew, Austin Barber, is one of the top people on Thad Cochran's campaign itself. So you would think that this would have been a very successful, well-organized campaign. It is anything but. It's a joke. You have a 36-year member of the Senate, one of the most powerful men in America, a very responsible man with a reputation of being an intellectual, being pounded into the dirt by a nut job who's not running a brilliant campaign. He's running a hard-fought campaign, but there's been nothing brilliant about it. It's weird, and I'll tell you, Democrats, the next United States Senator from Mississippi will be Travis Childers. And I don't say that rhetorically. I don't say that to be on message. I'm telling you, Chris McDaniels is going to beat Thad Cochran, but he is too creepy for Mississippi. Mississippi can deal with crazy. In fact, sadly, we sometimes celebrate crazy. But we don't like creepy. And while Chris McDaniels might be okay for a handful of Republican voters, he's too creepy even for most Republicans in Mississippi.
Well, that's I hope you're right. From your mouth to God's ears, or whatever they say. Go ahead.
Well, you're going to move it. You're kind of moving to the general. Has any polling been done on the general election campaign yet, or is it still let's get the primary over?
The last public polling done was just before the primary, and it showed that Travis Childers was against Chris McDaniels was neck and neck. Neither one had 50%. I don't remember the exact numbers, but they were both within the margin of error of each other. Now, to be fair, I do believe that beating an incumbent congressman, I mean, excuse me, an incumbent senator, probably will give him a bump. I would be shocked if it did not. But I want you to remember, this is a guy who cannot control his staff. His staff, one of his top people, is nearly arrested on election night of the primary because he and the chairwoman of the Tea Party in Mississippi are found locked in the courthouse at 2 o'clock in the morning in the room with the ballots. Now, the police haven't found them tampering with the ballots, but you've got to, David, you know, both of you know what I'm talking about. If we were ever alone with ballots, we would be freaking terrified. You don't, but they have a very amateurish staff who doesn't know that that could be taboo. He has volunteers, not directly connected to the campaign as far as we know, who didn't realize it'd be a really stupid idea to go take pictures of Thad Cochran's wife, who is, God bless her, not in a good state of mind. She has, I believe it's been well reported now that she is suffers from dementia. So they go, but that doesn't stop them. They go to where she is. They take pictures of her and put it on Facebook, put it on YouTube. They make a little video.
Yeah.
These people are out of control.
Yeah, let's get back into that. That was one of the, you know, the main things that really seemed to, you think, affect this race. How come that didn't backfire more on Chris McDaniels or his campaign?
Because polling has done so little, it's a little hard to say exactly whether or not it did or did not. But I think, in part, Chris McDaniels supporters are a tiny fraction of the general election electorate. They represent a highly paranoid group of people. So when they saw it, what they thought was this was a setup to embarrass Chris McDaniels. You know, it wasn't that these are absolute morons who don't have a clue what they're doing and no scruples. It was, well, obviously Thad Cochran has set this whole thing up to embarrass Thad Cochran. I mean, to embarrass Chris McDaniels. And so many of them believed that. But I don't know that it did not hurt Chris, honestly. You know, there's this narrative that says that that was a big boost for Chris because it made him look sympathetic, because it made so many did think that Cochran had something to do with it. But ultimately, I don't know if it had much to do with the final result. There was the final result being so close, I guess you could say even that a small percentage could have been the difference. But I think that Thad Cochran's unwillingness to campaign was infinitely more important than that thing with his wife. But it does show you what's going to happen throughout the general election. That is not going to be an isolated event. Chris McDaniel's supporters are so paranoid and so bizarre and so living in another world. These things are going to happen straight through the general election. Watch. It will happen, and it's not going to be the kind of stuff that's fun. It's going to be the kind of stuff that gives you the creeps. And that's why I don't think he's going to win the general election.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch that campaign, because that's obviously one that the Republicans probably thought, we got this one locked down. And if they don't hold that seat, then they probably have to need to pull up an upset somewhere else, or makes it more vital that they win to Arkansas or North Carolina, which is more of an uphill battle. Well, let's continue moving around and talking about upsets. This past week, the Virginia primary happened. Nobody thought it was going to be that eventful. And Eric Cantor lost to a guy named Dave Bratt, once again more of a Tea Party candidate. Seems like these two races are a little bit of the resurgence of the Tea Party, which was considered DOA. Catherine, how surprised were you on this, and what are your thoughts?
I think, like everyone, I was shocked. But my question all week has been did David Bratt win? Is it David Bratt? Did Bratt win, or did Cantor,
yes.
Or did Cantor lose? That's sort of my.
I definitely.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think that's the question, and I think the same thing, and I think Robert makes a good point that that Cochran lost. You know, he was not ready for this election. He was not ready for this campaign. He wasn't willing to be out on the campaign trail. He's not talking to the press. So I think I hesitate to give the wins, these wins to the Tea Party. I'm more willing to give these losses to the traditional GOP.
Well, it means that you're not connecting with this Tea Party element that's taken over the Republican. I think anytime an incumbent loses, it definitely shows that the incumbent gave that challenger an opening. And, of course, Chris McDaniel sounds like a little more of a polished candidate than Dave Brat. I mean, Dave Brat just
no kidding.
Filed the right time. Robert, what's your thought on this win?
Well, I can tell you I was absolutely shocked. One of my I have a friend of mine who was working on Brat's campaign, and I have a lot of friends in both parties. I can tell you they had no idea this was coming. None. Completely clueless. They were basically driving before the election day was even over. They had, you know, in my case, a friend of mine who had helped buy the last minute airtime, and they just hear on the radio that Eric Cantor has lost, and it was not even close. But you know, as political professionals, I think one of the roles that we have to play, particularly with our friends, is to remind them that don't get caught up in a media narrative about what's happened, because we don't really know what happened there. That state has very little history of a Republican primary, so you have very few people who go and vote. The majority of Republican voters in Virginia, the hardcore, long-standing Republican voters, don't have a history of ever voting in a primary. So very new. Maybe you could say radicalized. You could certainly say enthusiastic voters, people who don't owe Eric Cantor anything, were much more likely to show up. But I'll tell you what I think, and this piggybacks off what she said just a moment ago. Eric Cantor put a lot of money on television, but I'll be willing to bet you he did not run any kind of field operation. And Joel Kuhn, who I know you know, made a very good observation, which was, the polling may not have been wrong. If you polled Republicans in that district, Eric Cantor very likely was winning. It's that the turnout was so small that a very intense ground operation played a significantly larger part of the electorate than of the vote turnout than it would in most campaigns. And I don't know if that's an accurate way of looking at it or not, but I would not be surprised if that is true. You know, we talked about this a lot in the South, or maybe all over, but we often will be in the middle of a campaign, and we get into these fights of should we be spending our money on media or should we be spending our money on a ground game? And in the South, if you're a Democrat, if you can't do both, you're not going to win.
Right.
And I think what happened in Virginia is I don't think the Republicans have typically had to deal with that. And I think that Eric Cantor is an example of just how quickly the political tactics that are called for can change. I'm guessing. Again, I don't know, but I'm guessing.
Yeah, and my question, and of course I need somebody that needs a little more knowledge of this thing, is I look at the 7th Congressional District, well, 7th that Eric Cantor serves. It's suburban Richmond. It's just outside of Charlottesville. I don't know if Charlottesville, Virginia, where the University of Virginia is, has enough population to have suburbs, if you will. Maybe exurban Washington, D.C. So it's not really – no big cities based in the districts, but you can tell it has population off of all three of those places, if you will. But it's still – it's not rural Virginia by any means. And is it moderate enough, at least the people – if Dave Brat, some of the statements are coming out about him, is it going to be to the point where Jack Trammell, the Democratic nominee, has a chance? Now, either of you know anything about the makeup of this district or Jack Trammell to know if this thing could possibly be in play now that the Tea Party candidate won?
Well, I know that Trapp is already making a lot of ridiculous mistakes. I don't know anything about Mr. Trammell. If he is a solid person who is willing to work hard and listen to good advice, I think he does have a chance. I think that district, I think I've heard that it votes for president roughly 57% Republican. So it's a pretty hard Republican district, but not impossible, I don't think, for a Democrat. But I know Mr. Bratt, this Republican insurgent, you know, he went to a virtually unknown theological seminary that just happened to be in Princeton, New Jersey. So he would tell people he went to Princeton, which is technically true, but it was not Princeton, the Ivy League university. It was this college that just happened to be in the same city. And little things like that, I suspect, are going to continue to roll out on him. If the Democratic nominee has some substance, I think there's a real shot there.
This is a perfect example of being ready, even if you think things might not go your way. You know what I mean? Like, we often, you know, say, you know, if only the Republicans will make a mistake, then here we are, we're poised to win. And so if he's ready, if he's got, like Robert said, if he's got some ground game, if he can raise some money, he should be able to raise a little bit of money now, I would imagine. And, you know, I think it's interesting that they're both faculty at the same university. That should be a little bit of a, you know, kind of media interest, just, you know, like a little competition within a university or a college. So, I mean, I think it's just, you know, if he's ready, he probably has a shot. But if he's not, you know, getting his game together, then he probably won't prevail.
Yeah, the good news there, I guess, Jack Trammell already has a website up, can take donations in. His headshot looks like he has people that actually have a clue that you have to invest in something like that. So there's some good signs there. Can he take advantage is what we have to see. Well, let's move to the far west of the South in Texas. We kind of had two stories kind of come out of Texas this week. One, there's a new poll. University of Texas and Texas Tech, they got together on something. It was a poll for pretty much all of the races, but we'll kind of stick in the top level on that governor's race. And it shows that Greg Abbott, the attorney general, is leading State Senator Wendy Davis by 12 points. And we've been seeing a lot of these governor's races faring a little better for the Democrats, but this one, not so much so. And, you know, of course, you know, Texas and Georgia, the two big prizes that Republicans still hold. Georgia's looking a little better in polling. Texas appears to be not. Of course, this could be a bad poll, and we didn't get any cross tabs out of this one, but it was definitely not a good sign. Catherine, you saw this poll. What do you think? How bad a sign is this for Wendy Davis?
Well, she's got a tough road ahead, I think. You know, I guess the demographic shift isn't moving as quickly as we hoped it would in Texas, across Texas and the whole state. And I think, you know, she may be an example of something that I don't usually buy into, but she may have peaked a little early in her, you know, in the filibuster last year and all the, was that last year or the year before? I can't even remember.
It's been within the last 12 months, yeah.
So I wonder if, you know, she just sort of peaked too early and is now just trying to catch up to get the kind of momentum that she'll need to prevail in November.
Yeah. Don't know if this is anything telling, Robert, but every single race all the way down to the railroad commissioner, which is an office in Texas, if you like play Monopoly on and all four of those, the Republicans lead every single race. So is this just maybe a more Republican-leaning sample, or is it just a, you know, people are going to vote straight ticket and Democrats are going to have to wait another cycle?
I think that Wendy Davis is an extraordinary nominee for our party, and I am in no way going to say right now that she cannot win that race. One of the things that I thought was very telling, that in Texas, what is the most Republican state in our country, maybe with the exception of South Carolina, even though he is leading her, he did not get above 50%. Now, in that state, being the Republican nominee should guarantee you somewhere between 55 and 60% of the vote. But he cannot get there. I think that two things will have to happen. One, he's going to have to make a misstep. And two, it's exactly what Catherine said a moment ago. For Democrats in these tough states, it's about having a viable person there, plugging away at it day after day, who can then take advantage of a misstep. And I think that she's facing a lot of headwind because while I think a lot of Texans might respect her, I think that the idea that she's almost a national candidate with so much of her support and money coming from outside of Texas, that maybe a lot of Texans felt a lot of sort of in the middle of the road Texans did not care for that very much. But I don't think Texans love Greg Abbott. I think they're just sort of de facto responding to him because they know him, because he is the Republican nominee. But I'm not at all willing to give up on Texas. I'm going to watch that very closely, and I would not be surprised to see Wendy Davis start to make a turnaround there. I think that's going to be a race to watch on election night.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, she's one of the best candidates to put forward the state. It's just going to be interesting to see how fast that state changes, or, you know, can they change the minds of the voters that already live in Texas and have been voting for several cycles now. Well, let's kind of continue to stay in Texas. And Rick Perry made the news twice this past week, the comments he made. And I just want to ask y'all, which one do y'all think is going to be more controversial to some of his voters or future voters, should he decide to run for president again, which that seems to be the reason people think he's still in the news. He, at one point in the week, compared homosexuality to alcoholism, which when you read the quote, you think he's talking about, you know, genetics, and he's saying that, you know, there could be some genetic basis for that, which if you say, hey, I believe people are, you know, born that way, to quote Lady Gaga, that may not be that virtual, but then when you compare it to alcoholism, that usually is pretty negative. So that could have some brushback. And then Rick Perry, the Republican, praised Hillary Clinton. He said she was a very, very capable public servant, a great Secretary of State, First Lady, very capable. And she said great First Lady, essentially, and one of the major things she did was trying to have a national health care plan. So you could say this was a tacit endorsement of Obamacare. Guys, I'm going to contend that among his base, he's going to have to walk back these Hillary Clinton statements even more than his other comments, to which the, you know, the general public might think they're more offensive. Robert, how surprised were you by these comments? Which ones do you think hurt him more, or will they affect him in any way?
Well, I think we have to consider the fact that Governor Perry might still be taking medication for that back surgery, because he just says these things, and they come out of left field, and I don't believe he has – I mean, I wish I could say his remarks on homosexuality were the ones that shocked me the most, but it was the Hillary Clinton thing. Right now, the issue for conservatives on a national level is Hillary Clinton's role in Benghazi. And for any major Republican player to praise her is probably worse than praising Barack Obama, I would think. But the thing on homosexuality, I well remember, and Catherine, you'll remember this, when Trent Lott, the senator from Mississippi, was Senate Majority Leader, he compared homosexuality to kleptomania. And, you know, people did not like it even then, and you could get away with those things. I don't think it would not have cost him an election. But people don't like that kind of thing because people are not in the closet anymore. So you may very well have people who don't like the idea of gay marriage, but you can't get away from the fact that their brother or their sister, their son, their daughter, maybe their parents, their cousin, a very close coworker is gay. And it's not just, you know, it's not like you know a gay person now. You know lots and lots and lots of gay people, and they're close to you, and they're your family. And when someone says, that this person who you love dearly, who is a major part of your life, their being gay is like being an alcoholic. Well, if you have a gay friend who you love dearly and you have an alcoholic who maybe in your family who just is horrible to be around, you don't appreciate those things. I don't think he did any good for himself in Texas by saying that. The thing about Mrs. Clinton, that's just absolutely bizarre.
I have to agree that I think that the comments about Hillary Clinton will damage him more with the Republican Party and his Republican base, but I think his comments about homosexuality paint him as intolerant and sort of backwards. I mean, I think it's kind of a backwards approach. Like Robert said, you know, I think we're at a point now in our society where we recognize that there are gay people in our lives, and whether we support or don't support marriage equality or all the other rights for gay people, we can't ignore the fact that they are part of our society, not just on a personal level, but on a public level. We've got athletes, elected officials. I mean, it's no longer, I think it's just no longer tolerable to talk about people, to be an elected official in a position like governor of a huge state, to carry those ideas forward. I think I don't think it damages him as much with his base, but I think it damages him just sort of as the governor of Texas.
That's exactly right. He is the governor of every single person in that state. And for him to have just called tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people of his state essentially diseased when they are not, that they have something that should be treated, when they have something that should simply just be no more concerned about than anybody else's daily life, is absurd. And it weakens him. I think Catherine's exactly right. It will not hurt him with his base, but it makes it very difficult to really want to do business there. You know, Texas is on an innovation surge. They're trying to bring businesses from all over the world into Texas, and they've been doing a good job. Well, if you're a major corporation, maybe overseas, or maybe you're another part of the country, and you're thinking about going, maybe I could go to Texas, maybe I could go to Florida, maybe I could go to Virginia, maybe I could go to Georgia, and you're not really sure, you're testing the waters, and all of a sudden the office with which you're negotiating with is saying something about who may be the orientation of the CEO of that company, or a vice president of the company, or an investor, many investors in that company. It does not serve the people of Texas to have the governor saying such absolutely absurd things.
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of people in Texas seem to be getting wary of Rick Perry. Even a lot of the Republicans are ready for him to move on and turn the page, because, you know, he served two full terms and then the remaining portion of George W. Bush's term. I mean, I want to say he may even serve longer than that, because it seems like he came into office after Bush became president, and he's been in office all of the Obama presidency as well. We're looking at 14 years. Do the math on that. That sounds like three full terms in the rest of Bush's term. I mean, that is just a long, long time. I don't know who served as governor of a state the longest in American history, but I think if you had a top 10 list, it seems like Rick Perry would be on that list for good
Absolutely.
Or bad. But nobody's going to miss him until he's gone, because he has to go away to be missed.
Right.
Well, let's continue on this presidential mode, if you will, and a name I thought we were definitely done with, and really I think Republicans are going to be more done with, want to be done with this guy than Democrats are. I mean, personally, I say, hey, run this joker again. We seem to have the playbook on him, but Mitt Romney is making overtures that he may be running again. I knew that they had seen reports that he wanted to be the kingmaker, and I don't know exactly how he would have earned the right to become the kingmaker for the Republican nominee in 2016 anyway, but as ludicrous as that sounds, but it sounds like really they were misguided. He may be wanting to have another shot at the presidency. Catherine, do the Republicans want this? Forget the American public, just the Republicans.
No.
Yeah, I mean.
I mean, what is he came out in favor of the minimum wage, which is like poison to the Republican Party, to their base, especially their donor base. I mean, that's like, it's blasphemy. And you know, Romney Care in Massachusetts is the, you know, many think the model for the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, he has to take some responsibility for that. So, yeah, I don't think anybody want, you know, nobody got time for that.
Yeah. It just seems kind of crazy. Robert, your thoughts on Mitt Romney again. Third time in a row. This would be second time if he got the combination. I mean, the nomination.
I mean, I can only hope. I can only hope. But, you know, the Republicans do not have data analysis capabilities. It does not seem. They don't seem to be able to do polling very well. They don't seem to be able to do voter identification very well. And yet they spend obscene amounts of money on those things. If you are a multimillionaire who wants to pick a Republican candidate, I would not know who to tell you to go to put together the data to say who's electable and who's not. And it's very possible that Mitt Romney can fool these people into thinking that he's electable. He was barely electable inside his own primary, was never going to be president of the United States, and nothing. I love President Obama, but I can tell you, if he thought President Obama in 2012 was tough, if he runs against Hillary Clinton, she will pick his bones. He has no chance. Now, what they may be trying to do, or what not they, but what Romney may be thinking, is that Hillary Clinton, for some reason, may not run. And the Democrats go into a free-for-all and a party split, which I guess is possible. But I would have the scenario by which Mitt Romney becomes electable.
Yeah, I just don't really see his path to the nomination. Because to me, even more than the Democratic Party, I think the Republican Party, because, you know, by and large, a lot of Republicans have a little more privilege. They're used to success. They're used to winning in a lot of aspects of life. They really don't have a lot of time for a loser. And in addition to the guy doesn't really fit in with some of the new Republican Party. I mean, he's a Chamber of Commerce type Republican, but that's the Republican Party more so of 20, 40 years ago than it is today. And so I think they accepted him once because he had some money. He found the right split of voters. They kind of cycled through the Michelle Bachmans and the Rick Perrys in Iowa until he became acceptable. I don't think the field in the primary is as weak this time. I mean, I think a Marco Rubio or, even for a Ted Cruz for a Republican primary electorate is a lot more exciting than this guy. Even Rand Paul might be better in a 2016, you know, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, those states that matter. So,
well,
you know,
I would love to see that primary between Rand Paul and Mitt Romney. If there's anything I can do to make that the primary, then count me in. but it would be kind of fun watching. You know, the thing, what's so funny about Rand Paul, and I'd be curious if the two of you agree with this, is he's such a phony. You know, on the one hand, you know, I think his dad genuinely believes the things that he says. But Rand Paul is such a phony, and he comes across that way. He says the right things. He kind of knows how to talk that game up, but he just looks like a spoiled brat. And to think about Rand Paul and Mitt Romney in a primary together, I think that is exactly where the Republican Party is. Two overprivileged versions of Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and one of them is going to go against Hillary Clinton, and it doesn't matter because she's going to beat them.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's odds on favorite no matter who their nominee is. I just don't believe it's going to be Mitt Romney. Well, let's continue to move around the South, and let's go to Florida. And probably one of the more interesting governor's races, Rick Scott is defending his governor's mansion against former governor Charlie Crist, who's now running as a Democrat. And this poll from SurveyUSA is showing that Charlie Crist is leading Rick Scott 44-40. And while that's an interesting number, it shows 8% undecided, 8% other, you start looking at the crosstabs, and I'm really into SurveyUSA lately because of the crosstabs. It shows that Rick Scott has a 6-point lead among men, but Charlie Crist has a 16-point lead among women. And then if you look at the age groups, that gets fascinating. And 18 to 40, 34-year-old voters, the youngest voters are usually the most Democratic. Charlie Crist has a 1-point lead. Charlie Crist does much better among 35 to 49-year-olds, probably more parents, if you will, more likely to be, you know, parents with kids at home. He, Charlie Crist has a big lead among that group, 43-29. You can keep going down the line, race. Charlie Crist is 1 point down among white voters, and we know in the South, if you can go 44-43 in most southern states, and you're a Democrat, you are home free. But in Florida, I guess demographic makeup's a little better. Rick Scott, for whatever reason, his best racial group is Asians, 37-23. I don't know what percentage exactly of the Florida population is Asian, but I'm sure he would take white or black voters or Hispanic voters, which Charlie Crist also leads among, than Asian voters in Florida. Catherine, you've been looking at these crosstabs on these SurveyUSA polls lately because I've been sending them to you. What do you make of these Florida ones?
Well, you know, I think this this race is really interesting because it's sort of like the nice, handsome, you know, the boy that your parents want you to marry versus the cranky guy that nobody likes. And, I just think that, you know, nobody likes Rick Scott. I mean, you look at the numbers, like, he's just not well-liked. And my friends who live in Florida, now granted, you know, I live in a progressive Democratic bubble. I don't know very many people that don't agree with me on most things. So that's, you know. But people say that nobody likes him. He's just not well liked, Rick Scott. So I just think it's sort of an interesting. They're both sort of like caricatures of themselves, right? Like Charlie Crist, you know, the tan, you know, tall, attractive, personable, you know, guy, and then Rick Scott is the sort of the cranky, unfriendly, cool guy. So if that ultimately works in Charlie Crist's favor, I'm really happy about it.
Yeah,
I think that's
Robert,
exactly
I'm not sure
right.
I'm familiar with some of these SurveyUSA polls and the way they do the crosstabs. They also do the region. And that's kind of telling which parts of the state, because Florida's a very interesting state as far as geography and how that affects things. But what was your takes?
Well, when what I see with Chris Scott is someone who gives Democrats a big advantage, and that is how many times have we been involved in campaigns in which to campaign on the issues that motivate our vote, our base vote, we wind up losing people in the middle. What Rick Scott brings is someone who just naturally riles up senior citizens, naturally riles up environmentalists, we don't have to spend as much in Florida, I don't believe, getting to our base because he is so repellent to our base. What is surprising about the polling data there that is clearly is repellent to middle-of-the-road voters who once seemed to like him enough to make him governor, but they just don't. If Rick Scott continues to lose female voters like that, if those numbers stay the same, I mean, he certainly is not going to be reelected, I would not think. I mean, I don't see how anyone can lose the female vote by 15-plus points and get elected statewide in any state. But, you know, I never would have – I don't – you know, it's hard to believe because I remember when Chris was elected – when Chris was elected governor of Florida, I remember thinking, oh, good God, would Democrats have got to get it together. And now we're – you know, it seems that – you know, the better angels have come out in him, I might say, if I was being generous, and say that it has made him more of a progressive. But that's going to be that's an interesting race to win, but it doesn't look like Governor Scott is going to go back for another term, which is not displeasing.
Yeah, he's really, I mean, we have our friends from Florida, Anastasia Oppa and Greg King on the show, and both of them have just been telling us for really years now. I mean, Rick Scott just got in the office and just got so unpopular. I believe the governor of Pennsylvania kind of had that happen, which really I don't fully understand why they're more unpopular than Scott Walker is, the uber-controversial governor of Wisconsin. I wish a guy like that was that unpopular because of how he's trying to, I believe, lead some social trends nationally with his anti-union votes and different stuff. Well, we have a little more time, and I want to get something that's a little political but a little social in nature, and that would be Emory Sports Market Analysis, and that's Emory University in DeKalb County in Georgia, does these analysis of markets and seeing how well sports teams and different teams are supported in their communities. And you can go through the rankings, and I had no idea that here in Atlanta, the Falcons rank 31st in fan support. We sell more tickets than, say, a Jacksonville does, which is 27th. Actually, a lot of the Southern teams are rather low. Miami, Jacksonville, Tampa Bay, all in the low numbers. Atlanta's right there near the bottom. My question to bring it a little more political is, how much does a governor – I'm not governor, but more or less a mayor – because most of these teams are named after cities, how much can a mayor say supporting the team and we're going to bring more, not monetary support, but more civic support for the team to where people coalesce around that city and have civic pride for their teams? How much can that be a political issue? I mean, obviously, if you get the Braves or the Hawks popular in Atlanta and every road has a pothole, Kasim Reed would not be doing the best job he could, but he can fill the potholes and still make the Hawks, you know, have more civic pride or the people have more civic pride for them. Catherine, you live in the city of Atlanta, not just in the region like I do. Where do you think this could be?
Well, you know, I just don't pay that much attention to sports, but I was surprised at the rankings for Atlanta, because I feel like a lot of people are very, you know, gung-ho about the Falcons and the Hawks and the Braves. I mean, I feel like, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, we're building two giant, very expensive stadiums for both of them. So I was kind of surprised by that. I do think that having a mayor or other legislators, you know, other elected officials that are boosters for the teams helps. You know, like recently, I think it was there a hockey playoff lately recently?
Yeah, the Stanley Cup happened. Yeah. Atlanta didn't have a hockey team, but there are
right now. But it was it was LA Florida and New York. Teams. Is that right?
Yep. LA and
yeah.
Somebody.
Okay, so I watched in the morning, the morning after, and so they were talking about the playoffs, and apparently, you know, the New York Governor Cuomo said, okay, if we lose, we're going to send you, you know, blah, 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 all this New York stuff. And the same with California. Jerry Brown was going to send them something like silly, like rice cakes or something. But, you know, I think all that, like, you know, it's ha, 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 you know, they're all, but it still shows a sense of boosterism for those teams. So I think it helps.
Yeah, Robert, Jackson, Mississippi has a minor league Braves affiliate. And, of course, you're a worldly person where you've probably been to a lot of these major cities. How much do you think it could be where a mayor says, you know, let's get behind the team as a way to have more civic pride and maybe that improves the quality of life?
Well, you know, I find it impossible to believe that southern cities are not the most supportive of their teams in the country. I mean, it is in some southern states, it's sometimes the only thing you have to be hopeful about. I remember, of course, I grew up as a child watching the Braves on TBS when during the Dale Murphy years. And, you know, it meant the world when they won. When my house was destroyed in Katrina, and here in Mississippi and in New Orleans, of course, just devastated by Katrina, it was the Saints that finally made you feel like it was going to be okay. It was the Saints taking the field. I don't know. I think what impact it has on for a mayor to be a booster, I would think that should a mayor of one of these towns or cities actually do something really silly, like come out against the team, it would end their political career. But I don't know. That's a very good question, and maybe one that we as political consultants should look more deeply into, because maybe there's an angle there I had not considered. But the South loves its sports teams. Now, it just does. I take a particular pleasure in meeting an Alabama fan or an LSU fan and pretending not to be, just to watch their face turn the color of their school. my niece just graduated from the University of Mississippi. She's about to go to law school. And my sister, her mother actually just recently graduated medical school from the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And they are both just diehard Ole Miss fans. And I can tell you, if they were in the hospital sick, if there was an SEC game on, they're going to be watching it. So I don't believe that the southern states lack any support for their teams. But it may be that if you are a mayor, David, which you said a moment ago, is a big deal. When you're not sure your water lines are going to be able to survive a freeze, and you're looking at what could potentially be a multi-billion-dollar fix, and you don't have enough money for what you have now, it may be that we don't have the luxury of being able to cheerlead our teams the way maybe we would like. But there is no doubt that in the community we support those teams.
Yeah, I just think, and of course we just got a Major League Soccer franchise. I think this team, Reed, the mayor of Atlanta, was you know, at the press conference with the Falcons owner, because the Falcons are going to be somewhat the owner. I think they're actually not just Arthur Blank, it's the Falcons somewhat owns them. And, you know, he gets into that, and, of course, when the Braves decided to move to the next county over outside of his city limits, he had opinions on it. But to me, if you could say, look, we're 29th in the basketball rankings, 29 to 30. We're 31st in the football rankings with 32 teams in the NFL. I'm going to try to get our people to support our teams better, in which our university, Emory, out of the cab, is not going to rank us almost dead stinking last. And, of course, it could go for any city. I mean, not just Atlanta. So if you're listening to Jacksonville, you say, hey, we're going to be out of 27th. And some will say, you know, college sports affects that. But, you know, people that have go to that university and graduate for that university, and that's why they cheer for that university. And, of course, you got all the Walmart fans that, you know, they show up and buy the laundry and, you know, hadn't taken one credit hour at these classes and cheer for them like crazy. And you have to wonder about them, why they're not cheering for some of the pro teams, since they have no affiliation academically with the university. But that's another bone to pick for another time.
Robert, I want to thank you for coming on the Kudzu Vine tonight. You've been most informative about Mississippi and other politics that we've thrown at you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Every time I come on Kudzu Vine, I have a great time, and I have to confess that I rather enjoy the text messages and telephone calls I get afterward. It makes me feel more important than I am. But I was so glad to be on here with you and with Catherine. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being on. We always enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, Facebook that thing out, because we know you have a legion of people following you on social media. But, yeah, until next week, Catherine and I will be here next week with Kudzu Vine.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a